I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to be talking about community revitalization and how places around Indiana are tackling the issue. My guests are authors James Fallows and Deborah Fallows, the authors of the book Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America, Kira Amstutz from Indiana Humanities, and Molly Martin from New America, Indianapolis. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about community revitalization and how it is being done here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are authors James and Deborah Fallows. They're the authors of the book Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. A returning guest, Kira Amstutz from Indiana Humanities, and Molly Martin from New America, Indianapolis. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much.
It's good to have you here. So, Kira, why don't you tell us a little bit about why we've got all of these people here today?
Oh, thanks, John. We're really appreciative of the opportunity to be on today. So Indiana Humanities, along with New America, are hosting Jim and Deb for a four-city tour up I-69, and we're launching Indiana Humanities' new theme, Inseparable. We're really looking at the state's urban-rural dynamic, and this book was the perfect way to kick off that two-year exploration.
And you have an event this evening, though, right? Correct.
Oh, you bet we do. So I hope that your listeners, if they're interested in the topic of the conversation, will come to the Central Library tonight at 6:30. The moderator for the conversation will be local journalist Adam Wren. So join us at the Central Library at 6:30. Tickets are available at IndianaHumanities.org.
And is there a cost?
No, the event is free.
Okay, so basically it's reserving a spot. Molly, tell us a little bit about New America's involvement in this.
Certainly. Well, New America is a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank based in D.C., but I live in Indy, and I work in the Midwest and work in Indiana. And our partnership with Indiana Humanities was about finding ways that Americans connect and talk about public problems and the way they solve public problems. That's what we focus on in New America in a variety of ways. Jim and Deb's book is about that, finding people doing things in innovative ways to make their communities better. And by partnering with Indiana Humanities to expose Jim and Deb to some of the innovators here in our state and have the innovators in our state hear from Jim and Deb about the great ideas they're seeing all over the country. It's a way to spark optimism. It's a way to spark action. And we're just really thrilled to have New America family members, Jim and Deb, here with us.
So, Jim and Deb, you've been set up now here, I think, an introduction. And I should talk, say a little bit. I enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
And I know I'm trying to struggle with a way to create a portrait of it for our listeners. I know you compare it to, like, John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie and maybe even some of William Least Heat Moon's work. The thing when I was reading it that reminded me more of was Joel Garreau's works, The Nine Nations of North America and Edge City. It had some of the same sort of deep map quality to his work. So talk to me, and I'm not going to get into the middle of a husband and wife dynamic here, so I'll let you guys decide which one goes first. Talk to me about how the book came to be.
So I think thanks very much, John. I believe Deb is giving me the blessing to start first. So I see her eyes across the microphone.
You ought to be able to read her better than I can.
Yes, so. it's been a long and happy trail. So reading Deb has been is my primary skill. The short way to describe what we've done over the years in working for The Atlantic, Deb and I have lived all over the world. We were in China for many years. We were in Japan and Malaysia. We've done a lot of national political reporting. But starting about 6 years ago almost, we wanted to do interior American reporting of places that are normally in the news only when something goes wrong, when there is a natural disaster of some kind or a human disaster or a political campaign. But we wanted to try to see what local level America looked like if you weren't asking people about national politics. If instead you were saying what's happening with the schools, what's happening with businesses coming in or not, what's happening with downtowns. And this, and so we had a little single engine propeller plane. We went all around the country to about 25 cities for a couple weeks each. And our main message was the contrast between the tone of national politics, which is so polarized and so difficult to make any progress, and the fact that most people, most places, even with serious problems like in West Virginia or Mississippi or Central Valley, California, feel as if the movement is in the positive direction. So that's what we're trying to describe.
And Deb, how did you get to the idea of doing this? I mean, I understand what you were trying to do. What's the why of it?
The why of it really came from our previous journeys through China. We had been living in China for about 4 years and found it really valuable to go out to the small towns away from Beijing and Shanghai. And by small town in China, you mean 5 million people. It's quite different from small town here. But we did get out to a lot of villages, you know, dirt roads and paths. We took horseback. We walked. We hiked in and found that we really got to the heart and soul of the country by going to those little villages and seeing as much as we could. We came back to the U.S. and had a long history of flying around in our little plane. And I want to make clear, this is a little plane. This is not an exec jet. Mm-hmm. This is a single-engine, four-seater plane. When it's hot outside, you're hot. When it's cold outside, you're cold. You're usually hungry. There's no flight attendant. That would be me. So this was to the extent that it was like John Steinbeck, he was in a van. We were in a flying van, right? So the idea was to get back in touch with our country and do it the same way that we had found successful in China and to get out of Washington, D.C. for a good portion of the time, which is our hometown, to get back to the real America, which is where Jim and I grew up in small towns.
How did you decide? I'm going to stay with you, Deb, but I'll let Jim weigh in afterwards, give you the first word this time. How did you decide? Because you divide the book up with symbols. His is the airplane. Yours is like a feather pen symbol. How did you decide who was going to write which section? And, you know, most of the time it seemed like you were focusing on schools, cultural kinds of things, and you were much more economic development, business issues.
Yeah, you've got it. That's exactly right. And so Jim and I will kind of let you know it obliquely that we've been married for quite a long time, almost 48 years now. So we're not spring chickens
well,
at this.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. So we know each other quite well. We know our strengths and weaknesses. Jim has strengths. I have weaknesses. And we know who covers what. Usually in the towns, we would both go together on the first day and talk to what we call the usual suspects. Somebody in the government, in the school system, always the public librarian, because they really know what's going on in towns, the Main Street people, the economic development, and get a sense for where we might fan out into the town, and then went to the places where we were comfortable. And you're right. Jim has been a longtime political reporter, economics reporter, development reporter, and I have been tending toward life on the ground more with social institutions and places like the YMCA and the schools. So it was more efficient for us to split up and cover those territories where we were comfortable and did our reporting.
What was the strength of that approach, Jim?
The strength is that we it was a way to make both to keep our long-standing marriage going for for these years, too. And we have complementary interests. I mean, Deb is too modest to say, but she is a PhD linguistics person, and so she's written about language around the world. She wrote a much-praised book, including by Oprah, we lived in China, called Dreaming in Chinese, about what you learn about China by learning Chinese language. And so we're able to see different parts of the town and these communities. And I wanted to circle back to one other thing you mentioned about Joel Garreau, who's a friend, and we have many contacts in D.C., and his very influential Nine Nations of North America is complementary to. It's a great book. And he's talking about some of the regional differences in the country. We saw the regional differences, but also some real transnational similarities that whether you're talking about Mississippi or Montana or Vermont even, there's a sense of downtowns revitalizing themselves in similar ways, and young people choosing where to live in similar ways, and libraries playing a role in arts and humanities. So we wanted to say there is a national trend underway in addition to these enduring regional differences.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about community revitalization today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Molly, what was it about the work that appealed to you? Why was it that Jim and Deb seemed obvious choices for you?
Well, I'd like to be loftier than this, but thing number one was they wrote about my hometown. And I'm from Charleston, West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And no one is writing about Charleston, West Virginia. So it certainly hooked me right away. Thing two is I was a bit of a fangirl for Jim. I've been carrying a book around for 20 years that he wrote called Breaking the News. I actually just made him sign it downstairs. And I've had it in my backpack the entire time we've been traveling this week, which is certainly not being chill. I have no chill. But also, just as a new American, which is what we call ourselves at the organization, I saw in Jim and Deb's work what we try to do in our own work at New America every day. I saw the interest in finding what we have in common, not simply to just enjoy it or kind of bathe in it, but to take action with it. And, you know, when I go from community to community, I do work in India, I do work in South Bend or Goshen or Elkhart or Detroit or Northwest Arkansas, I hear a lot of commonality in the stories. And what I don't hear is that the rhetoric at the top looks anything like the action at the bottom. And I hear so much frustration, and I think that stymies our growth and our opportunity to change a community. And I see a lot of work going on in the neighborhoods here in Indy and other towns that defies what we think we know about policymaking. You see it in things like the local bike shop through the Learning Tree, the gentleman who's teaching the neighborhood kids how to repair bikes and run a small business. That's changing things in a way that we didn't think was possible anymore. We hear policy change and we think it takes months and months and years and years. That operation changed lives in a matter of weeks. And I saw that energy in Jim and Deb's book, and knowing what Indiana Humanities has been able to do by bringing people together to tell stories and have conversations, it just seemed like a perfect marriage and an opportunity to kind of bring that energy here to some towns that get overlooked, like Muncie and Angola, two of the stops on this week's tour.
So, Kira, same question to you. What was it about the book that appealed to Indiana Humanities?
Well, I think Molly has laid it out really well, but I will say the other kind of secret clue to us is that Jim and Deb are real humanities evangelists. So as a humanities organization, we care deeply about history, literature, civic education, world cultures. And so for us to find a nonfiction book that had so many elements of the humanities layered in, from Deb's examination of language to Jim's storytelling, you know, to us, it was a natural fit for the kind of work that we're doing. And I hope that maybe later we can chat a little bit more about the inseparable theme, because beyond this amazing tour, we have lots of other ways that people in Indiana can take part in these conversations and really think about how this urban-rural-suburban dynamic is playing out, and to learn more about the great stories that are happening across Indiana.
How did you, either one of you, Molly or Kira, how did you choose the communities that are involved here?
Well, it was a conversation with Indiana Humanities. Okay. Kira and I both looked at each other with one of those "you or me" looks. So we were interested in showing Jim and Deb the cities that do get overlooked. Obviously, Indianapolis gets its fair share of attention, but this is home for New America, Indianapolis, and Indiana Humanities, and we wanted to honor that. We were interested in showing communities of different sizes, communities that face different inequity issues. We wanted to show communities that have racial inequity issues to deal with. We wanted to show communities that are dealing with inequities as a result of labor issues, the result of departures of major industries. We wanted to show communities dealing with different poverty issues. And we wanted to show communities, though, that are inspiring us with the reinvention of waterfronts, the rehabilitation of fantastic old buildings, cross-sector partnerships, which Indiana is so good at. Kira, do you have things to add?
Absolutely. And you know, Fort Wayne, for example, they're working across 11 counties to solve community problems, and it's just inspiring. And to be fair, since Molly got to give a shout out to her hometown, I am from the county that Angola is located in, but I'm from a town of about 1,000 nearby, and there are just some amazing things going on in our smaller rural areas. So, yeah, it's a great this I-69 whistle stop tour is a great way to see all of the interesting things that are happening in Indiana and meet many of the great people who are doing the work.
We are talking about community revitalization today on No Limits. My guests are authors James and Deborah Fallows, Kara Amstutz from Indiana Humanities, and Molly Martin from New America Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about community revitalization and about how places around Indiana are tackling the issue. My guests are authors James and Deborah Fallows. They're the authors of the book Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America, Kara Amstutz from Indiana Humanities, and Molly Martin from New America, Indianapolis. I found the idea of using the plane also is interesting, because you wrote about the fact that it gives you a different kind of perspective. Most of the other books have been done from ground level, where, you know, Steinbeck obviously is driving his battered pickup truck around. William Least Heat Moon, I think, was in a van and all of that. And even Jonathan Rabin used either a boat or a car. So what was it about the plane that was appealing?
So I will start with this. Partly it's just that we have loved flying around the country in our little plane. So it was something that we knew how to do. The rationalizations I would offer would be these two. One is every place in the country has a little airport. There are 5,000 or so small airports around the country, and there are places that you would never go to at all on an interstate or by, you know, the big airlines, but you can get to by small airports. So we had experience beforehand knowing how much of the U.S. was accessible. We'd stopped in Red Oak, Iowa, and Rock Springs, Wyoming. I guess the other reason is that there is both a beauty and an instruction that comes from seeing the landscape from 2,000 feet up. Whereas you can see the beauty of the American continent as it unfolds beneath you, you can see why cities are where they are. You can see the passes and the mountains. You can see the waterfalls and the fall lines. And you can see the ports. And you can see the cities that have no obvious reason to be there, like Dallas. It's only worth.
Or, to be fair, somewhat Indianapolis, too.
Well, I was not,
yeah,
not
going to go there. Yeah, that we chose the exact geographic center of the state.
But. So it's a way that you can – so – we love doing it. It is so beautiful, and it gave us freedom just to decide, okay, we're going to go to this place and to change our plans minute by minute.
There are a couple of special things that you find in the plane that are different from approaching a town on an interstate or the back highway. You never have to go through the strip malls to get to the town to finally find where you are. You approach at a very low altitude, starting at about 2,500 feet, which is our most favored altitude, because you can kind of see the little Norman Rockwell scenes of where the school buses stop in front of the white picket fences and go on. Mm-hmm. But the small airports are usually quite close to town, and you get this view, at least I do as the passenger mostly, of what the environs of the town look like. For example, in Columbus, Mississippi, the airport is right next to the old blue jeans factory, which has been abandoned. And as you're flying into that tiny runway, you see that there are no cars in the parking lot. In fact, you can see the weeds coming up through the asphalt and think, this place has been abandoned for a long time, and get a sense of what you're about to visit.
We are talking about community revitalization here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ian has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ian, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly.
My name is Ian Mott, and I own Super Microgreens, which is a local farm in Indianapolis with my business partner, Jesse Hirschberger. And I was wondering about urban agriculture and what you guys saw on your trip. Or is there any? Is it coming back? Are we seeing a resurgence? What's the current state of not just fields, but more aquaponics, hydroponics, those sorts of things?
Thanks very much.
I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
So thanks for that question. Again, this was combined the national trend with local specifics. The national trend is locally produced things of any sort are really just a growing trend across the country. The brew house trend is part of that, locally grown produce of all kinds, local cheeses, local milk, local handicrafts. This is something that really is a trend of these times. And there were quite a few places where we saw where people were trying to use, depending on the real estate circumstances of each town, trying to use the opportunities to have in-town farming. Detroit actually is having a lot of this because there's so much vacant land in Detroit right now. Fresno, California. Deb.
And this crosses both urban and rural lines. We were in tiny Ajo, Arizona, population about 2,000 people, in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, which is a pretty tough place to grow anything. But the residents in the town worked with the Native American tribe, the Tohono O'odham, which is on the reservation right next to theirs. They reconstituted the old traditional ways of farming, and everybody in that town became a backyard farmer. And the restaurant in that town had urban to the extent that Ajo becomes urban, gardens where they figured out what would grow there, how they could use them in recipes, how they could make the entire population of the town healthier by eating fresh foods from the desert. Mm-hmm. So what your caller is talking about resonated from the biggest towns we were in, like Indianapolis is a big town, to the very smallest across the country.
How did you choose the communities you wanted to focus on? I'll start with Deb first on that.
Yeah, right? This was great. When we decided we wanted to do this project, Jim put a little article at theatlantic.com where he posts a lot of things and said, we're planning to go out on this journey, visiting towns around the country. Would you like to nominate your town? Does it have a story to tell? Tell us about your town. If you met with hardship, what's going on? Did you recover or not? Within about a week, we had nearly 1,000 responses of essays from people saying, here's my hometown and here's the reason to come to it. So we thought at that point, we were really onto something. People want to talk about their towns and they must be changing in some way in response to whatever's going on, even just the recession and the economic times. So we researched a lot of those, started out in a place or two where we knew one or two people, kind of threw a pin at the map, and went first of all to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and then kind of followed the trajectory on from there in a non-scientific way. But we made the grand scheme around the country and then started, people would email into us or we'd think we need to go to the Southwest or we need to go to a town that's having more troubles and not really succeeding grandly like Greenville, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So we tried to be as fair and comprehensive as we could. It's not a statistician's analytical report, but it's a human reporting story.
Jim, how did, of those 1,000 essays that you got, what were the things that caught the eye that made you say, this is a place we got to go to?
I think, as Deb was saying, it was a combination of plan and accident, like much in journalism. We'd go someplace and we'd say, oh, this is an interesting trend. Are there other places where this might be true? So I think what caught our eye was essentially something we hadn't expected. Now, one of my theories of journalism over the years is that reporting is what you didn't know until you showed up. Mm-hmm. And so people have said, actually, if you show up in this part of Mississippi, you're going to see things about the schools and about the industry that are different from what you think. And so that was the main metric. And there was then one place we went back to that we wanted to look at, we'd known for a long time and wanted to see in a different way. And that was my homeland of San Bernardino County in California. Many of your listeners will know San Bernardino as a scene of tragic shootings a couple of years ago. It's a famously failed town in California. Mm-hmm. But looking at it with new eyes was really interesting. We now think that San Bernardino's public schools may be the most progressive in the country, and that there was a surprise to find that out.
We are talking about community revitalization here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Eve has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Eve, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this wonderful program and opportunity to comment. I was born and raised in the northwest corner of our state, and I'm thinking in particular of Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, and wondering if you received any essays from that part of the woods, and if you did you choose them? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks
very much for the call and the question.
Mm-hmm.
So here is the thanks for that question. Here is the glory and the heartbreak of this project for us. As I say, we got about 1,000 essays, and there are about 25 places we were able to spend a couple of weeks or more. So there are 975 places we would like to go still, and the nominations keep coming in. I will say, even though I'm abashed to say this right now, there was not yet a city in Indiana that's part of our initial tour, but we will be back. And we spent the last while in Muncie hearing about things that are going on. So this tour this week is a way to kind of set the hook for Indiana.
So is there a second book in the works?
There will certainly be a new website coming out, you know, and we're doing a movie now with HBO, and so we're continuing on this theme.
And let me pick it up with Kira and Molly here real quickly. Why? Because I'm anticipating we will get the question. Why I-69 as opposed to I-65 or I-74 or I-70 or any of the other corridors? I'll go to Kira first, since Molly seems to be looking at you.
Well, she's looking at me, but I think there's a very practical reason. I think the fellows needed to leave out of a major airport in Detroit was on the top end, so we're taking them up through. So it's not quite that scientific, John. But I do want to pipe in on this process and say that the amount of excitement expressed by these 1,000 communities and wanting to tell the stories of their towns is a big part of why we were attracted to this book and why we thought this was a great kickoff to this theme. In the book, they talk about a term called conditional optimism, and maybe that's something they can help us dig into a little bit, because it's part of, I think, the importance of the book. It's part of the message of the book, and it's certainly why I hope lots of your listeners will be reading.
So, Molly, you have anything you want to add? You were looking
well,
at me.
I would just say that I know for a fact when we announced this tour, people from South Bend, people from LaPorte, people from Valpo,
that's true. I went to
people
Interstate,
from
so
Columbus
US
said, well,
too.
Why not us? And the answer is we will be back. And I know from my own work for New America in a lot of these communities, although not yet in Northwest Indiana, and we'd like to do that, people call us often and say, come here. We have something exciting going on, or come here. We'd like to figure something out with you. And I think that conditional optimism, and Deb will define that for us. She does it so well. Or Jim will define that for us, because he does it equally well. I've spent enough time with them to know. It really is the key to it, because these folks have a sense of what is possible in these communities.
Well, I think you've been cued, Jim.
I've been cued. Conditional optimism, I would define this way. It was something that I'd heard for a long time. Professor Nordhaus, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics a couple of months ago, was refreshing it in circulation. Complacent optimism is the idea that, oh, things will get better. I don't have to do anything because things will improve. Conditional optimism is the idea that things can get better or could get better, that if you apply the resources of the community, of its businesses, of its universities, of its NGOs, of its libraries, of its broadcast institutions, you could make a difference. If I got out of bed today and did something, it might move the ball down the field. And so that's been the case in many cities that we wrote about, where they have a sense of their own civic story, their history, how they got here and where they want to go. And so that kind of optimism, it connects the humanities with what we've seen, which is why we're glad for this program. Could I make one other language point to cue up for Deb, maybe? You were mentioning why I-69, why not I-70, et cetera. Where I am from in Southern California, we would say, why not on the 405? Why not on the 10? Why not on the 5? Why not on the 15? So there's a big regional difference in how we refer to the interstates. So go figure.
And have you found, one of the things that Steinbeck lamented in Travels with Charlie is that regional speech was disappearing, too. That would seem to be in your ballpark almost exclusively, Deb.
This was a question I had when we started out. Has the language all flattened out because of, no offense, national media? or are the regionalisms still strong? And I think the answer to that is yes and yes. To some extent, we all speak the same way because we listen to the same programs, watch the same TV, and so forth. But to a very great extent, there are these national, there are these regional and town phraseologies, accents that are still strong and going. One of the most interesting things we found was what we called the second question. It started in Greenville, South Carolina, where if you're at a party and you meet a bunch of people, they say, you know, what's your name and so forth. The second question in Greenville is, where do you go to church? Mm-hmm. And it's a way for the questioner to kind of let me put you in my world and how I can define it well. The church question was surprising to me. I'm from Ohio, Vermilion, mm-hmm. Ohio, which is right next door to you all, mm-hmm. to y'all, as we all say. Mm-hmm. And in other places around the country, those were very different questions. In Washington, D.C., it is, where do you work? New York, where do you live? In St. Louis, it's, where'd you go to high school? I'm waiting to hear what the question in Indianapolis is. What's your question, John?
My question and my second question.
Your
after
second question.
Well, it's odd because I'm taken off listening to you on that. And that is the case because in St. Louis, where I went to grad school, the public school system struggles and the parochial schools are really, really strong. So it's a way of identifying faith and or... Probably high school here still is a strong one because that's socioeconomic. Mm-hmm. That tells you what part of the city and where you came from. What was the most unusual of the second questions anywhere that you found that really kind of flummoxed you?
I have a favorite, and I'm not sure if they were pulling our leg on this. In Wyoming, the question is, did you get your elk yet?
Oh, yeah. No. That is a different way to live, a different way to live out there. What of this, real quickly, in all of the reporting and the research, what were the things that surprised you the most?
I think the number one big surprise was the sense of local level possibility at a time of national level diminished hope. Whenever I read a story in the paper now or on TV saying nation divided like never before, I think that's true of national level politics. It's not true of the fabric of the nation city by city. And I think here in the cities we've seen in Indiana so far, that seems to be the case. And so that's the biggest surprise. There are subsidiary ones, but that's the main one.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about community revitalization and, you know, how it's taking place in cities and communities here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are the authors James and Deborah Fallows. They're the authors of the book Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America, among other books, and Kira Amstutz with Indiana Humanities, and Molly Martin from New America, Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about community revitalization on No Limits. My guests are the authors James and Deborah Fallows. They are the authors of the book Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America, Kira Amstutz from Indiana Humanities, and Molly Martin from New America, Indianapolis. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Richard has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Richard writes, "As an architect, I am dedicated to the improvement of the built environment. Revitalization can be initiated but never sustained unless we look at our cities and neighborhoods as both physical and social constructs. Too often, city leaders or developers want to rely only on the veneers of redevelopment to paper over neighborhood challenges. We can and should make beautiful cities, but all the patterns of development, economic, racial, cultural, zoning developments, etc., must be designed and nurtured to create viable and successful cities. I think everyone, I can see the body language here, I think everyone's going to want a piece of this one, that question, because it gets to the heart of this. Kira, I'll start with you.
Well, I might just ask Jim and Deb to talk a little bit about the epiphanies you had when you were in places that had invested in beauty and in art and in design, and what impact that had on the community. Because I found those passages in the book to be some of the most moving to me, and I think an important reminder of the writer's point of why these things matter.
Well, and there was a commonality in the book, too, that a lot of the places that were, you know, like, there seemed to be a focus on biking and hiking trails and reclaiming urban space for livability and walkability and all of that. Jim, I guess.
So I'll start by saying, yes, I think Deb and I would agree entirely with the perspective of Richard who wrote in the sense that the development of a healthy community, like a healthy business or a healthy family life, it involves everything feeding itself, you know, in a virtuous cycle rather than the destructive cycle. And of course, economic development in the dollars and cents terms is indispensable to providing jobs and providing tax revenue and all the rest. But that is enhanced by rather than at odds with the artistic and humanities efforts that make a city a place where people want to be, where they want to spend their futures, they want to raise their children, they want to be involved in creating things. And so, for example, Deb mentioned earlier Greenville, South Carolina, which is now mm-hmm. often studied as an example of successful urban repositioning. It has its challenges, but it has mm-hmm. lots of things that it's done well. And part of its model is to make the downtown a place of beauty and interest and historical resonance. There are big bronze statues all downtown of a mayor named Max Heller, who sort mm-hmm. of pioneered downtown redevelopment, of a scientist, Dr. Poinsett, named for the poinsettia flower. He was the guy who discovered it. Of the civil rights protesters during the 1950s, some of the and 60s, in the sit-ins in Greenville. Of shoeless Joe Jackson, who played baseball there. Of ways for people to think, this is where I'm from. This is how I think about it. There's a beautiful bridge. They knocked down a freeway overpass over some falls of the Reedy River and have this bridge, which is now a gathering place. There's something called the Swamp Rabbit Trail that people of all different parts of society gather on. So Greenville has put a lot of money into getting industries there, but at least as much mind share and attention to how it feels as a place, why people like being in that community.
And one more thing that that Richard was talking about is the sense of public space. I think paired with what Jim's talking about in the beauty of the downtown rehabbed main streets are the big efforts that go into creating public social spaces for people. We often said that every town has a river walk, even if it doesn't have a river, because that's where the people of the town can kind of mix and mingle, and you bump shoulders with people you wouldn't normally otherwise see, and it really creates a sense of empathy with others in that way, and also a sense of kind of unity. Same with public libraries. I know that your public library has a brand new wing to it, which is not unusual. Most public libraries are doing whatever they can to bring it up to modern standards and make them open, welcoming places where the people of the town can all go for free to get information, to have social activities, to access technology, to create knowledge as well as consume knowledge. And the idea that these beautiful public spaces are there for the town to enjoy really makes it like a success on steroids.
What were the commonalities? And I hesitate to ask that question because one of the themes in the book is that place does matter. But what things, when you looked at all of these communities across the country that were finding ways to reinvent or revitalize themselves, what things did they have in common?
Jim is the master of this because he created the famous 10.5 points that make a successful town. Mm-hmm. And I know he would like to talk about one or two of the serious ones, like you have to have local leaders, or community colleges are an avenue for both vitality and creativity and accessibility for lots of different kinds of people around the town. And I won't be the spoiler on the half point, but Jim, I'll turn that over to you.
couldn't tell that they're married at all, could you?
Well, there's a range of commonalities, despite all the regional differences. Some of them are very practical, as Deb was saying. Community colleges, we really think, and career technical education programs matter, and a sense of making themselves deliberately open. People from different backgrounds, different generations, different ways of life can feel included there. The half sign of success on the 10.5 signs of civic success is whether there is a brew pub culture in a town, because no joke, that's a sign of a certain kind of entrepreneur, mm-hmm. a certain kind of way of redeveloping downtowns, a certain kind of new public space. We saw lots of places where they have children's rooms in the brew pubs.
Oh, yeah.
You can imagine the downsides of that, but I'm saying that.
Well, even in Greenville, the place that you're talking about, my son is a huge, huge baseball fan. So for a while, we would go see Class A baseball games.
Fun.
I've seen the Greenville Drive. Yep. Play and know that the field, actually right over the left field fence, there's a brew pub,
yes.
or at least there was a few years ago,
where
we had dinner. we had dinner there right before the game. So I didn't mean to cut you off, Jim.
No, I'm saying that there's a range. There's serious issues, and then there's the brew pubs. But it's, I would say, a spirit that people who are in that community are not just living there, but they feel responsible for the world outside their front door. They feel as if they have some, they're aware of the civic story. They have some connection to the people in that community, and they want to make it better.
Molly, and I'm going to ask Kira this as well. Really, what you're trying to do here is stimulate, a large state community conversation about, how we build our communities. What do you hope will come out of this city tour along I-69?
One thing I hope is that people leave thinking about some of the examples that Jim and Deb raised, like they're going to raise tonight, when I'm sure you join us at 6:30 at the Central Library this evening.
Well done, Molly.
Thank you. I hope that people hear the examples they raised from Greenville or Charleston or Sioux Falls or Dodge City and say, that could work here. And reach out to us at New America or others in the community and say, help us figure this out. Let's get together and let's try something. I hope that Jim and Deb leave with a sense of some of the great work going on here and use their platform to lift those up so that other cities and communities can hear about innovators working in Indiana and try it themselves. Because a lot of innovation in changing communities is about storytelling. The other thing I hope is that we all interrogate the idea of community revitalization a little bit every day. And to the point that Richard raised, make sure it's not veneer. Mm-hmm. Make sure that people are included in design conversations about the community they need and they want. And make sure that while we're dealing with the really important role of public art and beautiful green spaces, we're also dealing with whether or not people have a grocery store. So use these opportunities to come together to also kind of do a gap analysis about what our communities need, kind of in between the stories of hope, because there is reason to kind of capitalize on this optimistic energy.
Kira.
Well, I think Molly has done a great job, I think, expressing what we're hoping for. It's that sense of action, optimism, and hoping that you see yourself in some of the stories that you hear from Jim and Deb. And we are trying at Indiana Humanities and I know at New America to shine a spotlight on all the great things that are happening across Indiana. And I know we're talking a little bit today about this, four-day mm-hmm. whirlwind tour, but
it's
over the course of the next,
over
the course of the next 2 years, we are going to have programs in every county across the state of Indiana that folks can participate in. And in fact, on April 23rd, we're going to have one of our famous Chew on This dinner discussions that will be happening statewide in 10 cities across Indiana. So if you go to Indiana Humanities website, you can sign up. The conversation that night is going to be about what divides us. So we're starting off again the Inseparable program with another great way for Hoosiers to come together in conversation and think about their communities, think about what divides, what unites, and how we can charge together to charge ahead together.
And I will not be cruel enough to ask you to name those 10 cities quickly. And we've got to take a caller anyway. We're talking about community revitalization here on No Limits. Sean, you're on the air.
Yes. I just had an inquiry because I noticed you're talking about these different communities. And from traveling even down the 69 corridor in Indianapolis, there's a very real impact of gentrification on communities. So I was going to ask the authors, have they seen, due to revitalization efforts, where gentrification gets supported to do the veneer stuff, but the kind of the social network of those communities are lost? I'm particularly looking at Indianapolis, Indiana, where you look at a kind of our Indiana corridor, Indiana Avenue, which heads west. We've lost kind of a cultural identity in that area that was predominantly African-American.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be hard-pressed to recognize that ever because of the veneer. The social aspect of it is gone. And I'm just curious to see how that's impacted other communities, because I see the economics of it in small rural towns. It gets embraced where those local residents can come together to do something innovative. But it seems like in an urban market like Indianapolis, I just think in 465, we're not going to be considered a major city because the cultural aspect of African Americans is going to be non-existent as a community.
Thanks very much for the call and question, Sean. Jim?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Thank you very much, Sean. And I think just to build on what Molly was saying a minute ago, there are parts of the country where the big problem is the opposite of gentrification. The problem is people moving away and real estate values plummeting. And Charleston, West Virginia, for example, has one half the population it had a generation ago. And so there are all the consequences that come from that. In a way, it's a better kind of problem to have the consequences of cities attracting new people, but it is still a challenge. And so the cities that are fortunate enough to have made themselves attractive, to have new kinds of economic bases, to find ways to think about changes in technology so they have some economic future, they then have to be careful to find ways to be seen that it is inclusive, that it is fair, that there are opportunities for all the people who are part historically of the community. So I think your point is a very, very important one. And I think Molly, both Molly and Kira are parts of a movement here in Indiana to try to make sure that as cities solve their economic problems here in Indiana, they can be as inclusive, as fair, and as, you know, fine an example of their potential as they can be.
We are talking about community revitalization today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Patty has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Patty, you're on the air.
I'm Kathy, but that's close enough.
Yep, yeah. We can hear you, Patty. What's on your mind?
Hi. I've been listening to your program for quite a while, and I find it most enlightening. I think that the caller before me may have addressed some of my issues. I feel like it's all well and good to build all of these walkways and river paths and all that stuff, but you're forgetting the people that you're displacing in the process. I'm speaking about people who live in Fort Wayne particularly. I understand that there's a need to build the tax base up by increasing the luxury condominiums along the river. But when you displace people who live in subsidized housing and have no place else to go, you're not doing a service to the community. I know of at least three different complexes.
Patty, we're getting a little close on time, so I'm going to step in.
I need them to hear this, though. This lady lives, she's in a wheelchair. She lives on the fifth floor of this apartment building. When it rains, the elevator stops working, so she cannot make it down her steps. These are issues that need to be addressed now. Not with any kind of committees or luxury condominiums or river walks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it is a very important point. And the good news here is that we've seen a lot of attention paid to this in two different ways. Allentown, Pennsylvania is a great example where the Hispanic population there is right at the edge of the most redevelopment part of town. First and foremost is the worry and the grappling with how we make this an appropriate and affordable place to live for the Hispanic community who lives there now. So that we've seen case after case in town after town where attention is paid directly to that issue as a number one item. The second point is that we've also seen in a number of towns, Charleston, West Virginia, one, where there's a serious rehab efforts of various different sorts going on into the most distressed parts of town to rebuild the housing there and to make those neighborhoods much more attractive and and accessible to handicapped people who need them in a variety of ways. So I think both keeping the soul integrity of a certain area and building up the distressed parts of town in the same way that you're building up the downtown parts of town are two efforts that are not lost. They may not be talked about as much as the river walks, but they're going on.
Kira, we're running up against our time limit here, and I think pretty much what we've done with this program is just set up the conversation tonight, because clearly there's a lot more that needs to be discussed if we've gathered anything from that. So could you give people the details if they want to continue the conversation with Jim and Deb in person?
Thanks, John. Tonight's conversation will be at the Central Library. It is free. It begins at 6:30, but we do encourage you to go to indianahumanities.org and pre-register. That way you'll make sure you've got a spot. This, I think, will be a very popular conversation tonight. And you're right, this is the kickoff to a two-year conversation we're going to have in the state called Inseparable. We're grateful to New America for your partnership in helping us bring Jim and Deb to Indiana to get us started in such a thoughtful way.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Jim and Deb Fallows, Kira Amstutz, and Molly Martin for a great conversation about community revitalization efforts that are going on not just in Indiana, but around the country. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting station.